I don't think that I would be alive if I didn't know how to channel that pain somewhere.
There are multiple pathways to recovery.
You know what I think is at the root of so much of it is shame.
We need more compassion and empathy and understanding.
I'm the creator of my own destiny.
In 2016, nearly a million Americans used heroin. In 2019, 10.1 million Americans misused prescription opioids. While opioid and heroin addiction are more common among adults, nicotine addiction and vaping has been on the rise among teens. In 2020, over 30% of 12th graders have admitted to trying vaping.
What are the effects of substances on the user's mental health? What is the relationship between substance use, mental health, and music?
My name is Laurencia.
My name is Eric.
And my name is Alice, and this is Mental Massage.
When I turned 21, I started bartending. I was blacking out three times a week. I mean, it was like I was drinking so hard, and I had gone right back into that that relationship with substances.
This is Mary Lambert, who has since then recovered and become a Grammy nominee singer-songwriter. However, this journey was not an easy one.
And I was still doing my poetry, I was still doing my thing, but I still was pulled to this environment because I found a home with all of these people that were also doing this thing that felt fun and felt like, also I was 21, this was the thing I'm supposed to be doing. Everybody gets, you know, screwed up when they're in their 20s, you know? It seems like it's the normal thing that happens. So I didn't feel like I was doing anything like harmful to my body. I mean, I was losing relationships and friendships all over the place, but it didn't seem like, I didn't feel any sort of consequences, you know? And even like touring, I was drinking a lot while touring, and it's only been, you know, in the last couple years that I've really found footing in, oh, it's not normal to get blackout drunk. Like, I think I'd really normalized it in my head of like something that's really, that's just something that people do. And my partner and I met, we were both at a time in our life where we had kind of gone back down that road of like drinking a whole bunch. And my partner is actually sober now, but we both experienced that thing of like, we're getting blackout drunk together, like regularly. And we have a choice to make, like, do we want to really build this life that looks like we don't remember certain nights? Like, that's sad. I want to remember my wedding night. I want to remember like certain things. And so we kind of made that decision together. And I didn't mean to, but I haven't had a drink in a year. It was kind of on accident, but like, I feel like I've gotten a really good idea of the life that I want. And I think I've realized that it's not normal to get blackout drunk and to have to drink every night. What concessions I made and what sacrifices I made in order to keep drinking. And I think one of the things that I'm thinking of, there are a few gigs that I missed because I was like so hungover that I just like couldn't even make it to, or, you know, doing sound checks when I'm like throwing up on like off of the stage, you know, like I feel like I put myself in such really awful circumstances. And I don't feel like it cost me my professional career, but it definitely made it really difficult. And like further than that, what did it cost? And I was thinking, it actually cost money. Like I actually like, there's so many plans that I had for myself. I just bought a car. I never had my own stuff. Like, you know, I still own a house, and I'm like, you know, in my 30s, and you know, I'm seeing people, you know, have homeownership and have all this stuff. And I feel like I really, like for me, it was just so important over everything to have a pack of cigarettes or to have like, you know, to be able to get drinks at the bar. And that, like, I kept myself in a financially dire situation for even when I didn't have a place to live, it didn't matter. I wasn't thinking about saving for like first, last, and deposit for an apartment. Like I was thinking about how I was going to get like drinks that night. I just couldn't see that far ahead. So that for me, I'm thinking of an actual cost. Like it really, I feel so financially like that I'm still dealing with some of those ramifications. And, you know, that's frustrating. And also like relationships, like I had, you know, a couple ultimatums from people I was dating that said, I can't stand to see you blacked out drunk.
Mary was not the only one who lost once close relationships. Lindsay Arrington lost custody of her son.
I was misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. Mine was unresolved trauma that I had not dealt with. And so bipolar medications did not work for me, which is why I kept turning to other substances because I wanted the feelings to go away. It counteracted because my brain wasn't a bipolar brain. It was just reacting based on unresolved trauma and trauma responses, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, once I started to recover and started doing that like inner child healing work, and really identifying like the root issues, my spiritual brokenness, just like where all the disconnects lied, I was able to bridge the gaps, you know, between faith, discovering my identity, and then discovering my purpose. I think that was really like my path to healing. And a lot of people don't realize like how much your mental health suffers and how much it affects the actual chemicals in your brain and how it rewires you. And you have to actually heal your physical brain while you're in recovery. So for me, I used from the age of 16, 17 to the age of 22. And at 19, I had a child. And so the cost for me was losing my custody of my son temporarily until I got myself figured out and found healing and recovery. Fortunately for me, I was not gone from his life for more than 4 months, but that's not the case with others. Sometimes it can take years and sometimes it doesn't happen. That's a reality, but that was my cost. And so that ultimately ended up being my why. You know, why do I want to, you know, I contemplated suicide because when you're at the end of your rope and you feel like there's no hope for you, until you get a sliver of hope, you know, the only thing that you think of is like, well, maybe I should just not exist anymore. And that was a reality for me. And so when I thought of my son and how his life would be affected without me in it, it helped light a fire in me to choose how to manage my illness differently. And for me, that looked like seeking detox and treatment. And once I did that, it only took 30 days before he was back with me. And he doesn't remember a thing because he was under 2 years old and he's only ever known me to be a sober person who advocates for other people who struggle with addiction. So he also, you know, benefits from the knowledge that I have so that he doesn't have to go down the same path that I did, and that I understand trauma in such a different way now that I help him understand trauma so that he can address it now instead of having to heal from it as an adult after a bunch of self-destruction.
As of today, April 8th, it'll have been 10 years since she found freedom from addiction. Lindsay is now the founder of Hope Soldiers, a grassroots organization helping people around the world who are affected by addiction and mental health.
So I would say, you know, there are a lot of wonderful and amazing organizations out there. I partner with so many. And, you know, Hope Soldiers' mission is to bring awareness, restore hope, and love people back to life. And, you know, if people wanted to learn more, they could go to hopesoldiers.com and do that. But there are other amazing organizations that teach people how to write legislation and advocate from a legal standpoint through the state and, you know, try to get bills pass through that help, open up more pathways to people finding recovery and on-demand treatment and, you know, increasing the access to support and treatment. And Washington Recovery Advocacy Alliance, I think, is like one of the big ones that I would highly recommend that people look into, just even to learn more about, you know, what people can do to get involved, because a lot of people are passionate, but they don't really know, like, you know, where. But there are opportunities all over the place. I mean, a quick Google search would, you know, bring up so many different choices for people to have if they want to go in any kind of a direction. You know, you just take your skills and your experience and your passion, and you put it with something that aligns most with that, and that's where you should be serving.
No, well, I was thinking too on what would you sort of suggest on an individual level? Because I know that's something I've struggled with, friends that I know that are like really deep in addiction of, yeah, how do I offer hope and not enable, but like give resources and also not infantilize them, and not patronize them, but like, you know, I want someone to be able to come to me if they're struggling or hurting, but I find it difficult to create boundaries when someone needs something, but I'm worried they're going to use, but I don't know if that's my responsibility to worry about, but I want to do what's best for them. You know, what's your thought about like an individual level if someone's like, you know, family member is using and you know, they're out of touch with them?
I think the best way to approach somebody to offer them help and hope is to decide what you are willing to offer. I'm not willing to offer you money. You can't come stay at my house because it's an unsafe environment for me and my mental health. You know, and for me, I have kids and stuff like that. So like, I don't house people anymore. I used to, but I don't anymore. And you set the boundaries and the expectations up front. And sometimes there is pushback.
Right.
And you just remain firm in love and say, I hear what you're saying, and I understand that that is what you want. This is what I can offer you. And as far as learning what kind of resources are available to people, the easiest and best way to learn, especially if somebody does not have insurance and they have to navigate through a state system, every state in the United States has a state resource database where you can type Massachusetts state resources for substance use. It'll pull it up and it'll give some of the top organizations that offer peer support and connections to resources. In Washington State, we have the Recovery Helpline, the Washington Recovery Helpline. That is a helpline that you can call and say, I need treatment, or I know somebody who needs treatment. And they say, what area are you in? And they look up exactly where you are, and they help you figure out an agency that you can go to first get an assessment. And then the agency can either place you, or you can take the assessment and place yourself in a treatment facility that is state funded.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you, Lindsay.
In trying to help someone, it is important to keep a few things in mind.
So Mary touched on this a bit, and I just love the way that she framed this. But basically, it's not necessarily that we need more education and knowledge on actual substance use disorder or mental health disorder. We need more compassion and empathy and understanding. We may not be able to relate. We may not be able to necessarily understand like the whole mechanics of everything, but being able to show and demonstrate empathy to a person that's struggling, regardless of whether it's different from what we know, whether we have an opinion about it or not, your opinion on their struggle is irrelevant. So I fully believe that rock bottom is not what helps people get to where they need to be. It's
totally
hope. And so if we're not giving people hope, then they don't have a lifeline and they don't have a reason to come out of where they're at. So It is up to the community, to family members, to be ready and willing to give hope to somebody who is struggling, because that is the key to recovery. It's not rock bottom. It's not, oh, we just have to wait for him to be willing. I've pulled people out of the woods and out from under bridges. And so I know that people who were previously may not be willing or talked to social workers and denied treatment from them had a message from me of hope and somebody that can speak their language saying, I was where you're at right now. I know exactly what you're going through. There is more for you. Having somebody tell you that makes a huge difference. I did not have that. I was alone. And so that's why I do what I do in advocacy and outreach for people who struggle with substance use, is because that's the key. That's the lifeline. That's what people need. It's the life preserver. When you're out flailing around in the middle of the water, in the storm, you need somebody to throw you the life preserver. Well, that life preserver has hope written all around it.
For users of substances who are seeking recovery, one thing that goes hand in hand with support from others is learning how to release feelings of shame and guilt.
You know what I think is at the root of so much of it is shame, because first of all, if you're raised in an environment, you know, with any sort of trauma, any abusive situation, anything, even like just like being raised in poverty is its own sort of trauma. But what happens is that there's an immediate sense of shame of, I'm not like other people, and I deserve this. I deserve to feel bad, and I don't deserve good things. I don't deserve to be in healthy relationships. I don't deserve to, you know, feel good and at home in my body. And I think what was a mantra that I started using at that time was, I'm doing the best I can with the faculties that I have at this time. And I think that is something I still use when I try to relate to other people that maybe are making choices that I don't understand, but just realizing that everybody is doing the best they can with the resources that they have right at this minute. And I think you aren't able to demonize people once you have that level of empathy. I think another thing that really helped me was connection. And that's one thing that a lack of self-worth and, you know, a not strong sense of self or identity does to you is it isolates you. And it makes you not want to reach out to people because you feel ashamed and you feel that like no one will understand where you're at. And especially if you're using and you, there's so much shame in that of like, we cast people out that are, you know, struggling with addiction. It is like, you don't want to hire them. You don't want to work with them. You can't be friends with them. And so they become incredibly isolated. And I think that the best thing that can happen for someone in that situation is connection.
Another way to help one recover is to discover passions that don't involve substances.
Finding a role model or finding somebody in your real tangible life that is doing cool stuff and doing something that inspires you, and finding that thing that makes you passionate that's maybe not the substance. And because it was around when I was 20 when I started doing spoken word, and all of a sudden I put all that energy that I was previously into partying or looking for the next high into writing and performing. And I made all these connections with so many wonderful people. And I found that community, I found that sense of home. And in that, I also met people that were struggling with the same thing. And I felt less alone and I didn't feel as shameful. And I felt like I could share my story. So I think those are all really beneficial things, like creating your own narrative about what your own story is, finding people that get you and that maybe aren't in the same exact situation as you are, so you can kind of see maybe where you'd like to go, is a really helpful thing. I was songwriting since I could talk, because I was singing and kind of babbling, and my mom is a songwriter, so I, from a really young age, got to witness how you can process and therapize yourself through writing music and singing songs and having your voice have this like divine connection to like a, you know, a higher power or your higher self. And we grew up in an abusive household, and it was a really rough environment to grow up in. And so I started, it was like a form of self-soothing. It was like songwriting as survival of, I don't think that I would be alive if I didn't know how to channel that pain somewhere. So for me, it's tied like intrinsically with mental health. And I feel really lucky that I have that as an option, as an outlet. I wish everybody had something like that, because it's just afforded me so much joy, and to live this really complex, vibrant life that I think if I didn't have, I don't know if I'd be alive. It was this turning point of, I know this sounds so stupid, but I part of my trauma from childhood, this isn't stupid, but what I'm about to say is, so part of my trauma is that I'm really forgetful. I just kind of, sometimes and I don't know, maybe drinking has something to do with it too, of like several blackouts, but I would lock my keys in my car. And I would do it so frequently that I opened a credit card specifically for calling AAA to break open my car. And what I could have done and what I didn't do is make a copy of my car key. But I thought, I need to learn how to do this. So I'm gonna punish myself and put myself further into debt. And I need to be a person that exists in the world that doesn't lock their keys in their car, and shame on me. And just like you said, Lindsay, it's like that failing was my own. Rather than thinking all of the circumstances that led me and my brain to operate the way that it does. And so I think I woke up one day and I had, you know, maxed out a credit card just solely for breaking into my car. And I woke up and I made 3 copies of my car keys, and I gave one to my mom, I gave one to my roommate, and I hid one at school. I lost it, I don't know where it went. but I'm not exaggerating, and this is not hyperbole or any inflammatory story. I have never locked my keys in my car again. And it was like, I let something go. I was kind to myself and I was gentle, and I just didn't deal with it again. And I don't know, it like unlocked something, and it gave me hope. It gave me this feeling of, I'm okay as I am, you know?
So like, it was like your key to your freedom of journey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, of like, I don't have to feel ashamed. I am the way I am, and maybe I just kind of need to work with that. And like, see what I need to, like how I can forgive myself and be gentle with myself in this process.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Mental Massage, and special thanks to Mary Lambert and Lindsay Arrington for making this episode possible. We hope to catch you next time.